Studio 22, you're listening to Servcast with your hosts William Lamb and Tyler Shores. Servcast is dedicated to challenging those who have a desire to serve, lead, and make the world a better place through the love of Jesus Christ. And now, here's William and Tyler.
Hey, welcome to Servcast. My name's Tyler. We're so glad you're joining us today. About a week ago, we had the opportunity to record in front of a live audience, and in this recording, we discussed the topic of justice. This one's a little bit longer, so we decided to break it up into two parts, and we have part one for you today. We hope that you really enjoy this this content, and we hope that you're challenged by it. Enjoy.
Justice. What we're doing for this is over the last few episodes, we've done a series of correspondence with benevolence lectures, trying to dig in a little bit more, have a little more conversation around these different topics. And this is our fifth one in which we're going to talk about justice. Like we said, William is a staple to Servcast. He's the director of the Leonard Center and a lecturer in benevolence. He's the founder and the host of this podcast. He's a Marine Corps vet and has been at Lee University for over 14 years. Holds a PhD in organizational leadership, and fun fact, last year he was named, he loves this, Tennessee Treasure. So if you ever see him, say, hey, Dr. Treasure, and he'll just gonna be so excited about that. So
wow. Thank you, guys.
We're also thankful to have Dr. Hayes, who is no stranger to Lee University students. He's been here for over 21 years. He's a VP of Student Development. He's also a lecturer in the Benevolence Series. And we're really looking forward to the conversation these gentlemen are going to have now. Thanks.
Hey, guys, we're glad you're here with us tonight on, as Tyler said, our first live audience Servcast, and we call this Studio 22. And you might learn more about that if you listen to our previous podcast. But I'm delighted to have our friend. Many of you guys know Dr. Mike Hayes. I call him Mike. He and I have been on this service revival at Lee for a long time. Mike, huh?
Yeah, we have. It's been a great journey.
I'm glad you're with us, man. We're going to just jump right into this interview tonight and kind of dig into this lecture that you have been giving to benevolence classes for several years. One thing I can say about this is you're not giving a stagnant lecture. It's fresh every year. And so take a few minutes, if you will, unpack that and just kind of tell us a recap on what you did in that lecture hall recently.
Sure. Basically, over the years, I've observed in myself and in college students for years, that we have brought what I would consider to be an inadequate view of biblical justice. I think that's changed the last few years because I think the discussions about justice have been enhanced in our culture. But basically, I like to start off with the thought that we have a pretty narrow view of what justice is. And what I found, and again, what I brought to the table as a Lee student many years ago, was I thought justice was really based on this concept of how we define something like the Justice Department in the United States, which largely deals with making sure that the criminals get what they deserve, that if you do the crime, you're going to do the time. You know, the old idea of eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. And all of that is part of doing justice, but what I've noticed again over the years is that it's very narrow. So what I try to do is I try to differentiate among various approaches of justice so as not to see that justice, again, is punitive, it's retributive, you know, it's based on the idea that it's about the death penalty, that it's something that's very static. It's something that's passive and blind, and something that's outdated and kind of Old Testament, to something that really Jesus embodies in how he treats people. It's restorative, and again, not primarily retributive. It's life-giving. In fact, if you take a look at some of the passages, particularly in the Old Testament, you see that justice is life-giving. It's very active. And again, not only is it not blind, but justice from a biblical perspective is actually very empathic. And when you think about empathy, it invites us to see other people's pain and enter in that pain. And again, I think it is totally embodied, lived out, epitomized in the life of Christ.
Mike, can you give us a simple, attainable biblical definition of this idea of justice?
Yeah, I think it comes down to two major principles for me. Number one, it's giving people what they deserve. Giving people what they deserve, and we can explore that a little bit later. But it's also putting things to right. Putting things to right. I read this many years ago for the first time from the theologian N.T. Wright. He talks about how God is a God of justice and how justice is about making sure things are right. And again, I think it's these two things intertwined, the idea of giving people what they deserve, and that is all predicated on the idea that each of us is created in the image of God, and that should drive our approach to justice. And then, of course, that's coupled with the idea of making sure that things are right, with an emphasis on the biblical take of living rightly, the idea of rightness or righteousness.
You know, you talked about this idea of these three images. Can you kind of give us a description of those three images that you talk about in the lecture and how biblical justice actually is different, in great detail in what maybe the world might think justice is?
Sure. The first image that I try to show is the blind lady of justice. It's a very Western conceptualization of justice. It is a woman who is dressed in all white. She's holding a set of scales. She's blindfolded, and she's wielding a sword. There are some really significant symbolic ideas that flow from that, is that justice is pure, that justice, in fact, is actually blind, and in the sense of just simply holding the scales, it's actually relatively passive. It's our job to put things on these scales to see what weighs more and what doesn't. And then, of course, with the sword, it's about retribution. Again, it's about if you do something wrong, justice is going to be active and exact its punishment on you. The second image I show is actually a drawing from a student leader from years ago. Her name was Kylie, and I teach an undergraduate leadership development course, and I used to ask them to draw justice. I'd give them just a plain white sheet of paper, tell them to take a pen or grab a marker, and I'd ask them to draw justice, and everything's off the table. So they draw justice, and Kylie drew justice in a way that captured the way that I narrowly defined justice when I came as a Lee student. And based on the center of that picture is this idea of the word, it's huge. She writes the word law right in the middle of the picture. And then there are a few other aspects of that image. One is a sheriff's badge. One is something that looks like handcuffs. And then the final aspect is a set of gallows to be hanged on if you commit a crime. So the first two images that I try to show, again, are very focused on the punitive or retributive nature of justice. And then the third image I show is actually a picture of a whitewater river. And it shows how that river is gushing, it's rushing. What's around that river is life. That river is a force that will cut through the side of a mountain given enough time. So the differentiation among those three different images is really striking. It's very powerful. So again, it's not that justice is primarily retributive. That's a part of it. But it's a life-giving. It brings water to a parched land. It cuts through the most significant obstacles. And it's out of Amos chapter 5. Verse 24, let justice roll like a mighty river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. So those are the different aspects of justice and really what I consider biblical justice to be.
Mike, what connection, you talked a little bit about a connection here, but let's unpack that a little bit further, because justice and judgment, you know, sometimes that's hard for us to kind of comprehend in a world of chaos and everything seems okay. But is there a relationship of sorts between this idea of justice and judgment, and how does the perspective of one of those kind of inform the view of the other?
Yeah, I think judgment gets a bad rap. In fact, it's kind of one of the dirty words of the church, I think. But what's absolutely amazing, when you take the passage in Amos chapter 5, and most of us have actually heard Amos 5, 24, we just don't know that that's what it is. When you think about Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous March on Washington speech, his I Have a Dream speech, near the end of that speech, he actually goes off script, and he talks about Amos 5, 24, about letting justice roll like a mighty river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. But in that context of Amos chapter 5, is God is confronting the religious leaders of the day because they're exploiting people and they're taking advantage of people. So God is confronting those leaders, and he's actually judging them, but through the judgment, he's trying to reorder the way that they treat each other, and he's trying to make sure that those leaders are taking care of the people under their responsibility. I also try to highlight Micah chapter 6, where, again, the leaders of God's people and God's people have gone astray. But again, the leaders are exploiting people and they're not treating them well. And he basically sets up this beautiful courtroom scene in Micah chapter 6. And God enlists the prophet Micah as the prosecuting attorney. God himself is bringing charges against his people, specifically the leaders of his people. And it's absolutely amazing. God himself is on the witness stand. It's a beautiful picture that this small book paints. And God, when he's on the stand, he's saying, hey, basically I've done all these things. What have I done to you for you to kind of stab me in the back and for you to not take care of the people that I put you in charge of? And then the people get up on the stand, they're trying to defend themselves, and they say, hey, what about all these calves? What about all these rivers of oil? You know, and in fact, they get to the ultimate sacrifice. What if I offer the firstborn from my family for you to forgive me for the sins that I've committed? So basically, they're abusing other people, and they're offering God an ultimately abusive sacrifice. Here, get off my case, God, get off my back, God, and have my kid. It's really harrowing. I mean, when you really put yourself in the scenario, you would imagine that these people feel quite guilty. And then it comes to Micah 6:8, one of the driving Bible verses in my own life. And Micah cuts to the chase as the prosecuting attorney and says, hey, listen, O mortal, you know what God requires of you, and what does he require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. And then I try to say, hey, listen, again, it's not some outdated Old Testament kind of concept, but when you look at Jesus' teaching, particularly in Matthew 23, when, guess again, he's talking to the religious leaders of the day, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, and he tells them, hey, listen, you guys tithe the smallest of spices. You tithe mint, dill, and cumin, the tiniest of spices. And then he says, but you have forgotten the more significant or the weightier, the King James Version actually says the weightier matters of the law. And he says justice and mercy and the idea of faithfulness. And then that's where it gets into this real cryptic kind of expression. You have strained out a gnat, but you've swallowed a camel. So the whole idea is that the images of justice are related to judgment, and what's happening in those three instances, God is bringing the noise to the leaders of the day and his people because they've been unfaithful. Here's the clincher, all the judgment is coming not for people to feel bad about themselves, but to reestablish, here we go, back to the original definition of justice, to make sure that people are getting what they deserve and to make sure that things are put to right. That's the point. So God will use judgment to bring justice.
Mike, you use this phrase, sin management, and anybody who's been around you over the years have heard you use that term. You know, one of the things that I'm concerned about today is, you know, as you talk about that and you talk about missing the big stuff of justice and mercy, what are some things that really we need to be paying attention to that might not be so obvious for us? What are the big things that maybe Jesus was talking about that maybe we need to be reminded that we need to pay attention to?
I think one of the big things for me is poverty. I'm talking about all types of poverty. I'm talking about economic poverty. I'm also talking about spiritual, relational, psychological poverty. Particularly in our culture today, I think there is so much poverty. People don't feel like they matter. People don't feel like it matters that they were created in the image of God. We all can give cognitive assent to that idea all day long, but at the end of the day, does that really matter for how we see ourselves? And does it matter for how we behave in our relationships? I also think that this whole idea of economic poverty, even though we're talking about all these other things, that, man, we cannot leave that behind. There was a story that was written nearly 20 years ago in one of the big San Francisco newspapers. They did the research, they identified that there are more churches per capita in Bradley County, Tennessee, than any county in the United States. How can there be such an intractable poverty problem in Bradley County when we are one of the religious capitals of the world? I mean, come on, religion is the primary industry of Bradley County, you know? So I think the big thing for me is that really bothers me. It grieves me deeply to know that we have one of the most religiously saturated counties in the country, and we can throw a stone from where we're sitting tonight and we will hit poverty. So how can that happen? I think also when people feel oppressed, I think we've got to be honest about what's going on. In fact, tonight, some of our students sitting here were out there at a protest tonight in Cleveland, Tennessee. There is a person running for office who is pressing this issue of let's make America white again. So when we know that people are being oppressed and are being devalued, I think we have to speak to those matters. Another one that I feel very strongly about is how we treat people in the United States in our justice system. If people are interested in that, there's a book by Brian Stevenson, a fantastic attorney. It's called Just Mercy. It's a wonderful book, and it talks about how we need to reform our justice system. So those are a few examples of things we've got to be aware of in our society.
I want to go back and look at maybe two or three things that you just mentioned. Maybe dig in just a little bit deeper with that, Mike. You know, this whole idea, this danger of kind of spiritualizing the gospel message. Now I believe in the gospel message, and I believe it to be transformational. But the concern is sometimes that maybe that gospel message is abstract or without the idea of kind of a social justice responsibility that we might have as believers. What do we do with that? What are the effects of that, you know, even at Lee University campus, campuses all over this country? How do we deal with that?
I think historically, and actually a fantastic writer, his name is Ron Sider, wrote about this many years ago, and he talked about how there's been this historic divide in the church of we've got to be focused on evangelism, we've got to win souls, we've got to go out and and pull the fish into the boat. You know, God has made us fishers of men, let's get them in the boat. But then on the other hand, there's this other kind of stream in the church's history of, okay, what do we do with people who are downtrodden, who are oppressed? And unfortunately, the way Sider has seen it is there's this bifurcation of we got to focus on winning souls or we got to do this justice thing. So I think we don't need to approach life with Christ in a bifurcated, fragmented way. There's a way for us to bring together evangelism and justice. That is absolutely critical to live the whole gospel for the whole person. There's also something too that I got to be honest that I'm really concerned about with our contemporary American church. We seem to worship a whole lot, and I don't know if those worship experiences ever translate to our really being like Jesus. In fact, I spoke in one of our chapels about a month ago, and I made this point. The Lord laid it on my heart. It's a really tough question, and I think it drives home the idea, but do we worship, or do we worship God? Do we truly seek to be transformed into the image of Christ to where our relationships are changed? You know, it's not enough to get the glory shaft and to have the whole vertical relationship, but that whole relationship is about horizontal transformation. So I think those are really critical in terms of over-spiritualizing things in the church. So again, to kind of sum that response up, a primary and almost sole focus on evangelism without taking care of the whole person, and then also just this kind of fixation on worship. In fact, one of my favorite books over the last few years has been a book by Mark Laverton. It's called The Dangerous Act of Worship. And he talks about how we're so focused on having these experiences that we forget about taking care of God's creation, mostly his people.
Three of your, I don't know if you call them heroes or just people that you admire, that you talk about often, transformational leaders, Martin Luther King Jr., Mother Teresa, and Bishop Desmond Tutu. And you actually give a quote in your lecture, and I want to read this quote. If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you've chosen the side of the oppressor. It's pretty bold, Mike. I mean, it's in your face, but here's my concern and my question, I guess. Being a bystander seems equally as wrong as an abuser. Do you agree?
In fact, some ways I think it's worse, because we are called to be the active presence as God's church in the world today, and to abdicate that responsibility is to basically shortchange what God is asking us to do as the extension of the church in our society. I think the words of an Israeli historian, his name is Yehuda Bauer, really come to mind. And he talks about, obviously, the perspective of the Holocaust, and he's talking about thou shalt not be a victim, thou shalt not be a perpetrator, but above all, thou shalt not be a bystander. And there's this idea in the social psychology literature that's called bystander apathy. When we think someone else will take care of the problem, we enter this phase of apathy to where we just are, hey, somebody else is going to do it. It's kind of this idea of diffusion of responsibility. It's not my responsibility. I just kind of give it to somebody else. So I think it's really critical for us to make sure we're not silent, because again, above all, thou shalt not be a bystander.
The church language kind of talks about this idea of the future and the reality that God's going to establish shalom in the world. What's the responsibility of us as Christ followers? You know, the whole idea we're a reflection and not a refraction of Christ. And so what is our responsibility today, and how do we need to be about that business of the kingdom work?
I start with the Beatitudes. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers. Peace is the New Testament word that we see there, obviously, in the Beatitudes. And in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for peace is shalom. So blessed are the shalom makers. That's the concept. And what is shalom? Okay, it takes on various aspects. It means that we are in a right relationship with God. It means that we're in a right relationship with each other. It means that we're in a right relationship with ourselves. But it also means we're in a right relationship with creation. So blessed are the shalom makers. Blessed are the people who help people get in right relationships with God, with right relationships with each other, with right relationships with themselves, and in right relationships with God's creation.
All right, let's get to the big question of the night. We've got an election tomorrow, mm-hmm. Right? Oh, we can hear the crowd kind of saying, you can breathe, it's okay, guys. You can do that. You know, So Mike, I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot here. I think this crowd would probably like to know who you're going to vote for tomorrow. I'm sure they want to know that. So before you answer that question, let me kind of lead it to you this way. This could be, and some will say, this is the most critical election in the history leading up to this point of the U.S. presidency. So are either of the four candidates, I think there's still four, right? Are either of the four candidates a candidate of justice, and which one are you going to actually vote for tomorrow? You guys want to know which one he's going to vote for? You want him to tell you?
Yeah.
So, yeah. We're not going to make him tell you that, just like we're not going to make you tell us who you're voting for. But I do want you, Mike, to tell us, because we recognize there are Christ followers, people who genuinely love Jesus and love other people who reside on both sides of this political camp. What do we do in a world of chaos? How do we approach that, and what do we do as Bible-believing Christians to make a difference, you know, in after tomorrow?
Well, let me preface everything that I'll say with saying that I'm with him. Now, hang on. That's not a cop-out. In fact, one of my favorite books about Christianity and politics was written by another guy that I love to read and love to listen to. His name is Shane Claiborne. And about 10 years ago, he wrote a book called Jesus for President. His whole push was that we as the evangelical church continue to look for some kind of candidate to help make the government do what the church should have been doing for decades, centuries. So I think it's really critical for us to talk about that. So Jesus for President to me means there's really no perfect candidate. I could find fault with every president who's ever sat in the Oval Office, every presidential candidate. But there are a few things that I want to make sure that we're pretty open and honest about. Number one, a Christian, and what I mean by a Christian, a person who seeks to love God with all of her heart, soul, strength, and mind, will not allow herself to be sucked into the cultural mentality and be aligned with one party blindly. At no point will a Christian stop thinking. At no point. In fact, another fantastic author, his name is Mark Knoll. He wrote a book back in the mid-90s called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And he said the scandal of the evangelical mind is that there isn't much of an evangelical mind. The idea that those of us who claim to want to live out the gospel, that we don't really love God so much with our minds, that's an indictment, and I take that personally. So at no point can you stop thinking. At no point can you stop applying the gospel in a way that is really relevant. I also think that there are not simple answers, and let me give you a specific example. Healthcare. Do people deserve healthcare? Is establishing systematic quality healthcare in our country something that should be part of our putting things to right? So here's the idea. Regardless of how you think and feel about this, here's my struggle with it. These are the types of things I think about all the time. We can implement Obamacare, Hillary Care, Trump Care, you know, whatever care, but justice is a systemic issue. And to say that another way, injustice is a systemic issue. We will not solve the healthcare problems in the United States by adopting a countrywide program. Now, here's what I mean. You're dealing with healthcare insurance on one level, but there are other things that are part of a potential solution. Okay, how are we as a country encouraging people to take personal responsibility for their own health? How are we as a country helping to change the way that physicians and nurses and hospitals go about delivering healthcare. And how are we, as a country, helping to bring about legal reform so physicians and hospitals don't have to pay out their ears for liability coverage? So it cannot be a simple fix. And that's where you all, as a generation, I believe, are called to use your moral imagination to create solutions that really help things get right and people get what they deserve. So at no point can we stop thinking, and we cannot allow ourselves to succumb to simple solutions, because most solutions, particularly with grand problems like this, are not simple.
Mike, thank you for your time. We're going to come back in just a little while, bring you back into this podcast. We're going to have some student questions coming up next, but we're glad you're with us, and we'll be back shortly.
Thank you.
And this concludes part one of our justice conversation. Come back next time for part two, where we'll have William's discussion with a student panel and Q&As from our live audience that night. We hope to see you back here in Studio 22.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Servcast. The thoughts and opinions expressed on Servcast are those of William Lamb, Tyler Shores, their guest, and no one else. Until next time, this is Servcast, signing off from Studio 22.